All right, hi everybody, and welcome to Lecture 82 in this American History Program of History at Our House for the Junior and Senior High class. We are now embarking on Part 6 of 6 in this American History course, so we're definitely now entering into the final stretch. We're going to be looking primarily at the last 100 years or so of American history, but before we dive into that, next week pretty much, we're going to look at a transitional episode that helps us to kind of bridge the America of the Civil War and Reconstruction and Industrial Revolution, the one that we've been looking at in Part 5, to bridge that America and the modern America around us. So remember that we're kind of got our procedure here, our studies are being guided by a little bit more precise question or inquiry into the past, where previously in American history we've been just interested in how did America come to be, that we've been kind of guided by this question or this kind of phrase. There would be no United States of America, dot, 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 right? Without, dot, dot, dot. Now what we're looking at is something more specific. We're looking at the United States would not be the country that it is today without, dot, dot, dot. So we're getting closer to the present, and we want to know more specifically about the America that we experience around us, the one that's going to matter more to us in the lives that we lead in this America-centric world. So it's this America that we're in definitely has a lot to do with the distant past, and all the anchor facts that we've studied are very relevant to the kind of life that we lead now. However, the modern America of the last 100 years is unique in a really crucial regard. Something that is going to be absolutely huge in your life, guaranteed. Continue to be. It was huge for the last 100 years, and I think it will be absolutely critical over the next generation or so as well. And that this feature of the modern America that we see around us is that it is an international police power. It is guided by a set of ideas which are essentially the opposite of that which the founding fathers promoted. And this makes the United States a very strange country. It's a country which has a certain set of founding ideas which are still kind of around, which are still influential in parts of the culture. And yet today, its leaders are guided by a set of ideas which are essentially the opposite. So try to imagine, you know, what that is like, or this can kind of be part of our thoughts going forward. What do we call that when we've seen this before, right? What do we call that when you try to have one idea and maintain the opposite at the same time? We've seen that, and we've seen how devastating it can be in a culture. Keen, go ahead.
Hypocrisy?
Yes, but in logic, there is a term for maintaining one thing and maintaining the opposite at the same time. It was I'll try to jog your memories here, right? Think about individual rights and slavery. What do we call that? When you try to have a system in which both are present, you are maintaining a What, Alexander?
Contradiction.
A contradiction, exactly. And so if you have a country that is based on the principle of individual rights and the protection of rights as enunciated by the founding fathers, and yet you maintain as your posture to the world the function of an international police power, as it turns out, you are also maintaining a contradiction. So that's going to be kind of or attempting to maintain a contradiction. And that's going to be what we are going to try to understand in the next part of the course here, is that there's a tension in American life today. And if you study history, you can become aware of it and you can see it. And if you're paying attention to the elections, one of the things that you will see in what the various candidates who are starting to jump out there and put themselves out there to be the next president, one of the big things that they're going to be arguing about is how should America act towards the rest of the world? And it's interesting to me because there are a fair number of candidates that are starting to step forward that have a policy or that have the idea that the United States should withdraw from its international police role. And this is in part a reflection of America's original founding ideas. In part, it's other views. So the people today that promote the idea of not being international police power don't have the same ideas as the founding fathers. But there's a kind of similarity there, which is really interesting. And there are others out there that believe that what America should do is go out there more aggressively police the rest of the world. So you see this tension in American culture today. And in particular, you see it with regard to the problem of ISIS. There are people that, you know, their answer to the ISIS problem is America should completely pull out of the Middle East. Then on the other hand, there on the other side of the debate, there are people that say, no, Americans should invade Syria and Iraq again and completely take over that region and destroy ISIS and be completely committed to it. And then you have other problems like what's going on in Ukraine today. And again, you see the exact same kind of split in terms of American thinking. You see some people that are saying, that has nothing to do with the rights of Americans. Well, people don't say that anymore, but they'd say, that has nothing to do with us, and so we shouldn't get involved. And on the other hand, you see people that are saying, no, we should get in there. We had a treaty with Ukraine, and it's our job to protect them from the big bully of Russia, we should completely be sending our troops in there, and so on. So you see this split in American culture. And you see it with regard to pretty much any problem that arises out there in the world. You'll hear in American culture, you'll hear advocates of intervention in pretty much anything that happens out there in the world. And then you'll hear less so, but you'll hear others that will say, no, what are we doing? Why are we doing these things? It's wrong, or it doesn't make sense, or it can harm us, so you see this problem. And it is a problem in American culture because America is the international police power today. So that is what we need to study historically. How did that come to be? The founding fathers definitely were very explicit and clear in their policies and in their pronouncements and in their advice to the nation. They said, don't do that. Just stating the matter negatively. And yet America is doing that today. So the question becomes, how did that happen? How did America go from its kind of original approach to interacting with the rest of the world and switch to being the international police power. And what we're going to see is that a crucial episode, probably the first important episode in this transition, is the Spanish and American War of 1898. And then after we're done with this war, we're going to see that, well, if we go and I share my screen with you guys again, after this, it's a constant. Well, it starts to be a constant here. For the past 100 years, it has been a constant. So we're going to look at, you know, a little episode right here, in between, kind of reading in between the lines of history here, an episode right in between the Civil War and World War I, where we're going to see this transition occurring. And then after that, it's constant. After that, the United States is going to be the world police power. And it seems, well, it just becomes taken for granted. And the American policy towards the rest of the world becomes one, this is a really good key vocabulary word, becomes interventionist. I'm going to put that in quotes here because it's a really good term. Or the policy becomes one of interventionism. For those of you who want the key word there. Interventionism means a policy of intervening. Very simple concept. As a default, as a standard behavior, regardless of context, regardless of any particular factors or specific situations, it is now expected that should something happen anywhere in the world, the United States will intervene. So that's called interventionism, that intervention is to be expected. Intervention is the default position. So, of course, what was, just to take us back before we, to observe the transition to interventionism, it's important to be really, really clear and remember what America was like when it was originally created. And when it was originally created, well, we have this key word for that era, the key word of independence. How did that translate? What was the kind of default position of the founding fathers with regard to the rest of the world? Let's remind ourselves of that in more specific detail. So, Keen, go ahead.
The founding fathers just wanted to be unentangled from the rest of the world. They only wanted to step up and intervene. Well, not even intervene. They only wanted to entangle themselves as was necessary to protect American individual rights. And so, you know, people might look at the War of 1812 and say, well, why'd you go to war with Britain if you want to stay unentangled? They did that because, you know, the British Empire was attacking our seamen and taking them into the British Navy. So that was the position, unentangled unless you need to be to defend the rights of Americans.
Okay, right. So the fundamental there is exactly right. So that's the perfect place to start. The purpose of government, as explained in the Declaration of Independence, the proper purpose of government, said the Founding Fathers, is the protection of the individual's inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So, if that's what a government is supposed to do, to protect the rights of its citizens, the question of how should a government relate to other countries is the answer gets measured against that standard. The standard is the protection of rights. And if other countries don't respect rights, don't recognize rights, don't understand rights, and are constantly at war with each other, as European history is clearly the history of such behavior, then how should the American government respond to that? The American government has to figure out how to respond to the wars of others in the context of protecting the rights of its citizens. And as Keane pointed out, the founders would say, well, the way to do that is to stay out of those wars. Because to get involved in wars is to get involved in mass murder, to put your citizens' lives on the line in the conflicts of others. It's not to protect their rights, it's to endanger them. It's to take their lives and sacrifice them to others. And that is not, in the view of the founders, the proper function of American government. So, George Washington says, France and England are at war. America will be neutral. We're going to stay out of it. And so on and so forth. As Keane was pointing out, if there's a case where Americans' rights are under attack, then, okay, we have to decide how serious is that, and we have to stand up to the bullies of the world. And so we've got the War of 1812 as an example of Americans going to war against a European power, but specifically for the purpose of standing up for the rights of Americans and nothing else. No interest whatsoever in who's in charge in Europe and what governments are running what countries or whatever. That's up to the other people. But as far as Americans' rights are concerned, we're going to defend those. All right? And all of this culminates in the presidency of James Monroe. And so with James Monroe, we have this policy, which is named after him, the Monroe Doctrine. And that policy says, America is fundamentally different from the rest of the world. This is a government of rights. And therefore, we have to maintain a separation from the politics of others. Same principles as Washington, same principles as Jefferson. All the founders were pretty much of the same mind here. That because America is essentially different from the rest of the world, it should maintain political separation from the rest of the world. So James Monroe said to the European powers, stay out of the Americas. We don't want you messing around here because that could endanger Americans. And we will stay out of your affairs as well, because, again, that has nothing to do with the rights of our citizens. So as a policy, the Monroe Doctrine, in kind of specific detail, says to maintain a political separation between the United States and the rest of the world. Well, now we're going to see a context in which that became pretty challenging to do. And the context was, let me bring up a map now. The context had to do with Cuba, which, as it turns out, is right here for those of you who need your world geography brush up here. And of course, this is the United States right here. And this is Florida. And as it turns out, if I remember correctly, Cuba's only about 50 miles away from Key West here, the southernmost point of the United States. So 50 miles. I might be wrong. It might be a little bit more, a little bit less. But so Cuba, all the way up until 1898, was still a part of the Spanish Empire. And that hardly comes as a surprise in a sense to us, because we know, of course, that Columbus sailed for Spain. So some of the territories in the Americas continued to be a part of the Spanish Empire. Now, how could that be if the Monroe Doctrine said we're supposed to have a political separation between the Americas and Europe? This is about as close as it gets to the United States. How could Cuba still be a part of the Spanish Empire? Well, Cuba was a part of the Spanish Empire when the Monroe Doctrine was announced. So what was the United States going to do about it? What does the Monroe Doctrine say to do? Alexander?
Don't
touch it.
Don't touch it. Exactly. It belongs to those guys. It has nothing to do with us. And therefore, we're not going to do anything. Now, but you can see how this is kind of an interesting problem, isn't it? Why does it appear, at least on the surface, to be, well, maybe a different case? Can anybody kind of imagine why this might, some people might say, well, no, we can't apply the Monroe Doctrine in this case. Or maybe they would say, as we're going to see, the Monroe Doctrine actually means something else in this case. It's one thing to say, oh, we're not going to get involved in wars in Spain. If Napoleon wants to invade Spain, we don't care. Oh, but what about over here? Wasn't there a kind of a similar case that Thomas Jefferson had to deal with that involved the French Empire, for instance? Do we have maybe some precedents where we can kind of bat this around a bit? What does it look like when a European empire is a neighbor of the United States? Do you remember a case that Thomas Jefferson had to deal with? Keen?
Well, there was the French. They owned what became the Louisiana Purchase once Thomas Jefferson bought it from France in order to make sure that if the French eventually came to settle it, which they probably would, United States and France would be neighbors.
Yeah, right, exactly. So France was a neighbor of the United States up until the Louisiana Purchase, and Thomas Jefferson said to Napoleon, look, if you guys come colonize this and we end up in any conflicts, I can pretty much guarantee you that we will make allies of the British Empire and we'll be at war. So Napoleon just looked at that situation and said, okay, fine, you can have it, and gave it up, and we have the Louisiana Purchase to expand the United States further westward. All right, so that's kind of an interesting comparable example to some extent, but what do you think? Is this equivalent, or does the fact that the Spanish Empire possessed Cuba, does it feel the same to you, or do you see a difference, or what's your sense of... what's the same and what's different, Bria?
Well, it would be, they're right next to you, and if they start having war, then it's likely that something's going to happen between Key West and Cuba, because they're so close, and something's going to happen, probably, and then you're going to have some sort of war.
Okay, so the proximity is the same. That's a good point. The proximity issue is the same. Or maybe perhaps not quite, because of the scale of it, right? I mean, if you say to me, well, it is a neighbor, well, then my answer, can anybody kind of make a debating point here and say, what do you mean it's the same? You can't say that this is the same. Like, the Louisiana Purchase is totally different. Can anybody who wants to enter debate club here and try to disagree with Bria? Bria, you're welcome to disagree with yourself as well. who wants to debate Bria on, it's not the same? All right, Alexander, why is it not the same?
Well, because the Louisiana territory is on the same continent, there might be like a mountain range there. I'm not exactly sure, but otherwise, it's just an artificial line, pretty much. Anybody could just go over there. While Cuba is, as you said, 50 miles away by sea.
Okay.
So you have to purposefully go there and land on it with your boat to get there.
Okay, right. It's not the same. And actually, the line, Alexander, was the Mississippi River. Now, that's actually, it's not an artificial line. It's it's a natural barrier. But at the same time, really crucial for navigation and for commerce. So, if you are, you know, if American farmers are sending their goods down the Mississippi, and French military ships are patrolling the Mississippi, yeah, oh my gosh, I mean, that's going to be a hard line to maintain in a kind of peaceful way, right? But my goodness, this is a really small stretch of sea here. It might be 50 miles across, and it's still 50 miles away. So yeah, you got to really go out of your way to create a problem over there, don't you? So yeah, I think that Cuba isn't, there's no way to make an equivalency between the Cuba situation and the French Empire in Louisiana situation. And I'll go further than that because, and I'm going to be cheating a little bit here, or some historians would say I'm cheating, because Cuba has been an enemy of the United States for the past 100 years. Well, no, all right, I'm exaggerating. It's been an enemy of the United States for the past 50 years. And because Cuba's a communist country. And you might have heard in the news that the president is trying to change that and has opened up diplomatic relations with Cuba recently. But Cuba's been an enemy of the United States for the past 50 years, and there was only one serious incident in which there was a conflict. And it didn't involve Cuba itself. It involved the communist Soviet Union and its attempt to place nuclear weapons in Cuba. But the fact is that Cuba's been there all this time as an enemy of America, and nothing's happened. So, apart from that, there, you know, I don't want to pretend that nothing happened entirely. We'll probably spend a moment talking about this in a few weeks' time. It was called the Cuban Missile Crisis. So there was a crisis pertaining to that. But it had to do with the fact that the Soviet Union was acting in a particularly belligerent way. So, yeah, I don't see the equivalency. Now, so what happened was, though, is that Spain, Cuba was in rebellion in 1898. There was a rebellion against the Spanish Empire. It was actually the second one in the history of Cuba. The first one had failed. And so in 1898, there's a new rebellion, and the Spanish Empire is sending its military to quell this rebellion in Cuba. And Americans, of course, started to talk this over. You know, Cuba had been a neighbor of the United States for over 100 years without any conflicts, even though it was still a part of the Spanish Empire. So that whole history by itself was a pretty good indication that it was not the same as the Louisiana Purchase example, right? So never mind the communist Cuba example of the past 50 years. Back then, you could look at Cuba in 1898 and you could say, the United States has been a country for 120 years, and Cuba's been there, a part of the Spanish Empire, and we haven't had any wars. So what's the big deal? If we're going to follow the Monroe Doctrine, we would have to conclude that, you know, our best policy here is to leave it alone. Now, there was more and more, there were Americans living in Cuba and conducting trade with Cuba and so on. Which was kind of a similar situation to how Americans might live or trade with Europe in the time of the French Revolution or other conflicts. So there's that connection that existed that presents a challenge, right? And when George Washington faced that challenge, he said to Americans, we're going to be neutral. You need to conduct yourself in a certain way because the United States is not going to get dragged into a war, a European war, because of that. It doesn't make sense for us to go to war for that kind of a cause. And the same thing, John Adams, you know, maintained an official peace, a quasi-war with France, because he didn't want to declare official war. And so this would be that kind of situation where, okay, there's a war, and American lives might be lost in some very small numbers, and people who decide to go into a region or live in a place that's at war, I mean, you make that decision, that's on you. And you cannot obligate the entire country of the United States to go to war with a global empire because of your personal decision to go live in Havana, which is at war. So, looking at the Cuban situation in 1898, which Cuba's in rebellion and there's a war and Americans are, you know, around in that area. Well, the founding fathers would have looked at that and said explicitly, we're going to be neutral and Americans, we want to protect Americans. We're going to help them to leave Cuba. We're going to, you know, insist that Americans be protected, but we're going to maintain our neutrality. And at first, it kind of looked like that. This was kind of America's posture towards the war in Cuba. And the United States government wanted Americans to leave, and it wanted Americans lives and their property in Cuba to be respected. But this led to a challenge because the United States sent a battleship down to Cuba called the USS Maine, and it was in port in Havana, the capital, and during the war, and it was kind of, you know, what we call nowadays a show of force. Kind of like, okay, you know, here's one of our big battleships, and just reminding you that we're the United States and we're next door, and, you know, you don't want to get in trouble. Right, so, and look at this big battleship, just so you can remind yourself of that and behave yourselves. Well, it didn't work. In fact, it had the opposite effect. The USS Maine was bombed. It was destroyed in port. And it was not clear how that had happened. The blame was put on Spain. But I think that it's presumptuous to know for sure what had happened. I don't know if anybody can, with 100% certainty, say that it was the Spanish that destroyed the battleship and not the rebels in a kind of attempt to draw the United States in. But regardless, it was destroyed. And that, of course, led to a crisis because now the United States has military vessels in Cuba. One of them, very important ship, has been destroyed. How does the United States respond? It was not an easy thing. Americans were definitely teetering on this issue because the Monroe Doctrine continued to be on their minds. And anybody that would have looked at this question clearly enough would have said, no, this is not something we should get involved in. And in a way, this whole bombing of the Maine, we brought that on ourselves. We should not have been stationing a ship in a port of a colony of another empire that's at war. I mean, that was just poorly thought out in the first place. We're better off withdrawing and insisting that Americans not go there. And this is definitely how the Founding Fathers would have done it. In fact, Thomas Jefferson has a record of doing things like that. He said to Americans, you may not trade with France. You may not trade with Europe at all during the Napoleonic Wars. And people were really upset with him over that. But basically what he was trying to do was make sure that nobody would get into a situation that would force America's hand and drag the United States into wars that it didn't belong in. But now this had happened and Americans were debating, well, is this a different situation or not? We've heard Bria tried to make a case, which was good, and then Alexander made a counter-argument, which was good, and I think Alexander's made the stronger point. I think Bria agreed. And definitely the founders would have looked at this situation and said, we stay out of this. This has nothing to do with the Monroe Doctrine. We're not talking about the Spanish Empire trying to conquer new territory in America. This belonged to them in the first place. If the Cubans are able to get independent, then we will happily recognize them and so on. But it's not our business to make other people independent from their own empires. But 1898 comes along. The USS Maine is destroyed. And Americans, of course, a lot of Americans were really upset about that. And the situation in Cuba was really under a microscope. Some people were just looking for any excuse to get involved. And you have this kind of, these kinds of people in any kind of country, regardless of what its values are. There are some people that are more inclined to conflict. You might know them personally in your lives. People that are more inclined to violence, or people that are more kind of violent in not necessarily physically against each other, but more violent in terms of yelling at others instead of being more kind of calm in their reactions to things and so on, right? People have different temperaments. There were leaders in America that were kind of itching to prove how powerful America is, to prove how great America is and tough and so on. So they were looking at the situation and just trying to find any reason why America could go to war with Spain and detach Cuba from the Spanish Empire. And they found it because the Spanish, they found the reasons they wanted, because the Spanish Empire was quite desperate. It was having trouble fighting its rebels in Cuba. And it was resorting to a policy of internment in concentration camps with large segments of the population. So when you hear the expression concentration camps, I hope you have an immediate association. This has to be something that everybody knows about. And if you don't yet, you certainly will by the end of the year. So concentration camps are usually associated with what despicable chapter in history? Cliff, go ahead.
World War II.
Mm-hmm. Especially what regime?
The Third Reich.
Mm-hmm. Nazi Germany, right? The concentration camps that held the Jews. So basically they're just large prison camps. And they weren't invented by the Nazis by any stretch. The Spanish implemented concentration camps in this war, this rebellion. And there were 400,000, people that were placed in concentration camps in Cuba, as part of the war effort. So this definitely set people off in America, right? It's hard to, it's certainly, if you have any kind of sympathy and empathy for your fellow human beings in the world, right? And you see them being treated this way, it's upsetting. And when Americans heard that the Spanish were placing their Cuban colonists in concentration camps, that made people angry. Right? And you combine that with the USS Maine being destroyed, you combine that with, well, Cuba's just right next door, and wouldn't we want it to be independent? Doesn't that sound nice? Let's kick the Spanish out of the Americas once and for all, right? You start piling these on, and it becomes harder to pay attention and follow your principles. The Monroe Doctrine. Becomes harder to maintain your loyalty to the principles that are in your best interest. Because you have these other motives. You have this desire to help people that are being hurt so unjustly by the Spanish Empire. You're angry because the USS Maine has been destroyed. You're worried because a neighbor of yours is, you know, in trouble. And so you've got all these different motivations, and if you're not capable of summoning your principle, your Monroe Doctrine, sufficiently well, you're going to end up wanting to go to war. And this is how enough Americans felt to tip the balance. In 1898, the United States decided to declare war on Spain. So, now, the thing that started, the reason why this decision, the decision to go to war with Spain over Cuba, started to turn the United States into a world police power, was that the Spanish Empire was global. This war, if the United States was going to go to war with Spain, it was not going to be a war that would be limited to Cuba. Because the Spanish Empire, you've got the United States here in the Americas, and you've got Cuba over here, along with the other Spanish colony of Puerto Rico. Well, meanwhile, on the other side, on the Pacific side, you've got Alaska and you've got Hawaii over here that belong to the United States as well. And you've got Spanish colonies, especially in the form of the Philippines. You go to war with a global empire, and the Spanish Navy has bases in the Philippines. You can't ignore that, right? You can't ask Spain to just kind of treat the war with you really gently and be nice and just fight over in Cuba. You declare war on somebody, they're going to fight you in every way that they can. And so the United States now was faced with a situation where it was at war with Spain, and that included being at war with Spain everywhere. And so the Spanish Navy was a global power. By this point, it was in decline. It wasn't quite the superpower that it had once been. You know, in the time of Columbus and Magellan and so on, Spain was the most powerful empire in the world. By this point, you know, Mexico and other countries had become independent. So Spain definitely did not have all the resources it once had. But it was still global. And it still controlled the Philippines as well as Cuba. So that meant the United States was fighting a country that had those resources and it would have to deal with it in that way. And it did. The United States, you know, strategically understood that it had to fight Spain everywhere, and it did. It sent its navy not just to Cuba and its army not just to Cuba, but also to the Philippines. And so it was a, you know, what you would call a two-front war, Pacific and Atlantic at the same time. And it won in both places relatively easily. So the United States was definitely a rising power. Spain was definitely a declining power. And this was kind of them swapping places in the world. And, well, but the United States now, as a result of the war, had destroyed the Spanish Navy in both places, the Spanish forces in both places, and occupied both places. And found that both Cuba and the Philippines would never be able to take care of themselves and maintain their independence from now on. That without American intervention, they would not have been able to win their independence. And so because America had intervened, now they were independent, but they couldn't stay independent. So by getting involved in this war, the United States had now become, in a sense, responsible for life in Cuba and life in the Philippines. Because, I mean, it's one thing to go in and destroy the, if you, I mean, maybe this is not true, and you can, you're welcome to challenge this point. But I'm trying to kind of characterize it in the way that people thought back then. You could take the view that the United States had no responsibility, that its job was simply to destroy the Spanish Empire and let the Cubans and the Filipinos, after that, do what they could. But Americans at this point were looking at it differently. They rendered these places independent, but looked at them and said, well, now that we've done that, they won't be able to stay independent unless we help. And this is where you start to get this international police role. Because at this point, the United States is not involved in a war anymore. It's defeated the Spanish Empire. But now it's going to police the situation from now on. It's going to say, we're going to protect Cuba. We're going to protect the Philippines from now on. Because we don't want to have defeated Spain and then, well, 5 years later, they reconquer Cuba and the Philippines and we got to do it all over again. So we're going to now police this situation. We're going to try to help these countries. We're going to take care of them from now on. This is the first time the United States found itself in this role and where Americans made this decision. So I'm going to leave that kind of to you guys for the moment to think about. Is, you know, does that make sense? Or do you take issue with that interpretation? Was it right? Was it wrong? I mean, can you see how America got involved in this? What's going to happen is it's going to proliferate. In other words, America's role in policing the world is going to continuously expand, and it hasn't stopped. So, you know, you can see how in this situation you go from trying to help Cuba, and all of a sudden, now you're starting to take care of the Philippines also. Now, what's next? Well, as we'll see, there is a next. And the next part's going to be Panama. And then after that, something else. And then after that, something else, and something else after that. And so this is the process whereby America is going to become the international police power. The puzzle is, well, kind of to make sense of it. How did it happen? Why would this necessarily happen? After America for over 100 years had been so committed to not doing this, how come it started doing more and more of it nonstop? It's an interesting puzzle. I'll let you ruminate on that one. See what you can come up with. How do we make sense of that is going to be one of our challenges. All right. Anyway, but that's where it begins. 1898. America is going to be the international police power. All right, we'll pick things up on this front on Monday. Of course, tomorrow is History Through Art. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you tomorrow.
Bye.
Bye-bye.